get to feel it. I was back in the old days, long ago.
You know, I just don't want people to remember me as being just part of Queen. I want them to remember me as doing other things as well.
I paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence but committed no crime. And bad mistakes I've made a few.
Theatrics I get up to on stage are me doing my job. We were outrageous at that time. I mean, look at David Bowie when he started up.
Welcome. This is The Rock Podcast. I'm Denny Somach, along with my co-host, Anita Gevinson.
Hey, Denny.
Hey. Today, it's Queen. Now, I got to tell you, I was going to pull a bunch of interviews. I have a bunch from Brian May and from Roger Taylor and something from John Deacon. And I was going through the files, and I came across this file that just said FM on it. So I didn't know what it was. Of course, I opened it up, and it was an interview with Freddie Mercury. And I thought, wow, that's good. I forgot about this one. And then I started listening to it and I realized, wait a minute, I don't think I've heard this in like 30 some years. And what it is, it's an interview recorded in 1984, around the time of the release of The Works, which was their 11th studio album. I think it came out the end of February in 84. So this was probably done in the first part of that year. And rather than edit it and chop it up and figure out what to play, I figured, you know what? You never get a chance to hear Freddie Mercury. Let's just play the whole thing. What'd you think, Anita? You heard it.
Well, especially in the context of, you know, knowing about Freddie Mercury's life and knowing how close this came to his diagnosis. And this is one of the last, I think, fully... without that knowledge in his head interviews, you can just hear him just so hopeful and so planning the future for himself. And, you know, he was born on September 5th, 1946. So, of course, it makes him a Virgo. And you can tell by all the different kinds of control he had about the different facets of business and entertainment that he wanted to do and the different areas he wanted to work with. Yeah, he just, that was his nature. He died in 1991 at 45 years of age. He was diagnosed in 87, but people say he was symptomatic 1982 of his bronchial pneumonia. And he didn't confirm it till the day before he died. He kind of kept it to himself, but everybody kind of knew. It was a very strange time for people to talk about AIDS and their physical condition and their sexual orientation. It's just a shame that he was born at that time and not later on. It could have gone a lot differently.
Yeah. And I mean, he was a huge personality. It's hard to believe he's been gone all these years, but I remember I was in Montrose, Switzerland, about 10 years ago, and they have a statue of Freddie Mercury overlooking the water.
That's you just amazing. Have to imagine what he could have meant had he been able to fully, you know, have control of the end of his life.
Yeah.
Because, you know, because so many people related to him without even knowing everything about him, that he could have been even bigger. But hey, he lived it well. He lived and lived it well. And as Rami Malek portrayed him in the movie Bohemian Rhapsody, he was a complicated guy.
Yeah.
Very complicated guy. And I did like the movie. I liked the portrayal and I liked the end of the movie when they did the Live Aid reenactment. I thought that was brilliant. Yeah. But I really like the 2012 Freddie Mercury, the Great Pretender documentary. If you haven't seen it, it's really good. But I have to say, I've never heard him as candid and unedited.
Yeah, I mean, I think our people that are listening are going to be. It's like being a fly on the wall, really. I mean, you're there, you're seeing it. We left everything in. We didn't cut anything out. They talk about, well, you'll hear. We'll come back. We broke it up into pieces. But
and the interviewer is
Mary Turner.
Woman who's dear to our heart, Mary the Burner Turner, right. Who Mrs. Norm Pattiz.
That's who she was.
And she does a wonderful job. Obviously, they have a rapport, a relationship. And she was crazy about him, and he appeared to feel the same way about her. Right. Yeah, I think people are going to love it and be surprised of all the things they thought they knew and all the things they never knew.
I couldn't take it off. I just like, whoa, listen all the way through and like, wow, I listened to it a second time. Yeah, so I just I listened to the whole thing, and then I was like, wow, riveted. And I played it again, and then I sent it to you. And I just figured there's no point in doing editing here. So here is part one of our interview with Freddie Mercury.
But Munich, as opposed to your own studio in Montreux?
I hate my studio, to be honest. They're killing me for saying that. We've used that as well, you see. And they'll kill me for saying this. I like Montreux, but I mean only for like a couple of days. And that's not enough to make an album. It's nice. It's very scenic. I mean, you've got a wonderful view. There's a beautiful lake. And it's nice. I mean, I just... I don't mind doing a few, maybe the odd track there, but I'd hate to sort of think beforehand that I'd be saddled with a whole album over there, or even a major part of it. I just couldn't go through with it, in our own studios. Munich, I like, because I like the city. I like, you know, it's very clean. It's very safe. When you live in New York and then you come to Munich, you just think you can have your car and you can park it anywhere without thinking, oh God, it's going to be gone by the time you come back. And it's just different, apart from the fact that everybody speaks German. It's okay. I'm learning a little bit of German, too.
But you also did, was it the mixing of this album in L.A.?
No, the mixing was done here.
Oh,
that's what I said earlier on. It's nice to come back to, for the tail end, it's nice to come back to a studio that you do know and recognize so that you know what the sounds are going to be like.
Is this the first digitally mastered album you've done?
Yeah. That's right.
What's that mean?
Oh, don't ask me. I don't know technology. You have to ask a Mac. It's just, you just get a cleaner sound and you just bypass certain generations of tape that way. You know, it's just a new way of doing it. It's all very clean and you virtually get the kind of sound that you do create in the studio outside. Because most of the times when you do it in the studio, and by the time it gets on record, it's you know, you lose a generation and sort of... It's basically just trying to get the cleanest sound possible that you can get. And digital masterings are almost there. You know, they're the cleanest at the moment. Apart from that, that has about as much technology I know. Ask me about something more fruity. Go on.
Okay. The last album was kind of a, we talked about it when it came out, kind of a departure for Queen. And it seems on this, you know, more on the funky side it was.
Yeah, everybody seemed to hate it. It was just something different. It was very different. We were out on a limb, and we wanted to do something, and I still think that is a good album. I mean, I know it didn't... Of course, the only way people gauge albums these days is if it was successful or not. If it's a successful album, then it's a good album, isn't it? I mean, you know, that's the way I guess you have to gauge it. But for a musician, I mean, of course, I mean, we wouldn't have put it out if we thought it was a second-rate album to start with. I mean, but we were out on a limb. We wanted to do things that a rock and roll act hadn't done before. I mean, go straight into the black area and do funky stuff. And it's okay if you sort of do things like that in the beginning, but after a while, if a group is, you know, if people sort of get to know you in a particular way and then you change so quickly, sometimes, you know, it's hard to grasp. And then the timing and, you know, it's got to come out at the right time. I still think that if that album, say, came out about, say, now... people will be more aware of it, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm.
Just at that time, you know, now the Michael Jacksons have suddenly happened and you know, it's being in the right place at the right time.
Speaking of Michael Jackson, you guys are good pals.
Yeah, we still, we worked on three tracks. I mean, that's about a year ago, and we still haven't finished them. My sort of projects never seem to get finished, I don't know why. maybe it's me. No, it's... he's very busy. You know, we talk to each other now and again. But first, I was going to be on a Thriller album. Then I was supposed to do something for the Jacksons album. And he's in LA. I'm in Munich. And well, something might happen on my solo album. See, I've got something up my sleeve.
Uh-huh.
If there's time, you know, I might go to LA or and finish these tracks. You know, I'd like to finish these tracks. The funny thing about it, we wrote a song together called Victory. We haven't finished it at all, and I hear that Jackson's new album is called Victory, but I don't think the song's on it. And, so he's just used the title. I'll kill him if he used the song without me.
You hear that, Michael? He's taking a ton of crap right now from Jehovah's Witnesses. I guess he's quite a religious guy, right? Well, they're saying that he's much too suggestive. And
no, he is a Jehovah's Witness.
Right,
so,
they're saying that he's not behaving like one. Yeah. And he seems like rather a clean-living kind of person to me.
I don't know. To be honest, I don't know. How does one live like a Jehovah's Witness? I mean, well, I suppose you've got to do... The only thing I know about that is there's, you're not allowed to have any blood transfusions and things like that, which I think he's deadly against, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I didn't know that he was... I thought he was quite... quite keen on that thing. I know he loves animals and things like that. He's okay. He's all right.
I think it's the dancing that's got them down.
Is that it?
I think they.
He's got to do something for a living. My God, he's a musician, and I don't know. I think he does everything quite okay. I think. I mean, I couldn't do what he does because I mean, he's just a totally different life. I mean, he just doesn't eat meat, and but each to his own, you know. I mean, I think in the end, it's the music that counts, and he comes out with very good music. He's a good lad. He's a real good man.
This being your 13th, is that your 13th album?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, number 13.
Lucky 13. Is it hard to stay?
Sounds so old.
Is it hard to stay motivated?
It is hard. Yes, it does get a. There's different ways of looking at it. I mean, sometimes you just think, okay, you've done enough, and you do want to do different things. I mean, I'm still hungry to do things, but it's not the same kind of hunger. It's a bit sort of, you know, okay, you've done this. And so you think, okay, I'm going to try this, and if it doesn't work, I'm going to try something else. It's not that, it's got to be this, and this has got to happen, you know, this has got to work this time. There's no sort of, it hasn't got that knife edge. But there are different ways of looking at it. I mean, you're more mature, you're more experienced, and so you have to sort of look at it a bit more, a bit, with a more cool outlet, you know. It's just got to be a bit more cool, and... I don't know. I don't mean blasé by that. I just mean that you be a bit more experienced about it. You know, you don't have to rush things.
Plus, I would think that change is very important to a band that's been around as long as Queen, because how can you stay interested?
You're dead right. We hate each other. We hate each other's guts. No, it's just... we've sort of been together 13 or 14 years, and after that time, I mean, if you're still together, you like each other instinctively, and you don't have to sort of think about spending social time together and things, which we hardly ever do together. So, I mean, basically, we only come together when there is music. So basically, it's a job. I think we all look upon it as... And I think we're professional enough to think about it that way. And I think that's good. So we keep away from each other's territories, to be honest. Otherwise, I think I'd just tear all my hair out and you know, jump out of a tall building, to be honest, if I had to sort of, you know, live the way we did in the early days. But a group has to go through all that, you know, to start with, because you have to get to know each other and their musical abilities and this and that. I think we've done a lot together, and I don't know, I think now all we're doing is just staying together to make music, which is what we were initially there to do.
Does the idea of how can we top this ever enter into?
It happened at a very early stage. After Bohemian Rhapsody, it was like people were saying, how are they going to top this? I mean, if you go sleep at night thinking about how you're going to top what you did, I mean, you just that is going to be your downfall. You know, you've just got to say, okay, it's done. That's the way I look at it. I mean, music is just... It's a big consumer thing. You just consume, as far as... our music is, I think I said that last time, as far as our music is concerned, people should just listen to it and discard it and wait for, and that's what people do, wait for the next one. I don't like harping on, of course it keeps coming back, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody always comes back, We're the Champions, that was, and people have to take note of that, but I mean, as far as I'm concerned, all those days are over, that era is over, that type of music is now over, and I don't wish to even think about it or write about it.
Disposable, I think, is the word.
Disposable,
you used.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. Like a tampon. Yes, it's I like it that way. That keeps it fresh, you know, and I mean, even like, say, the works, okay, the album is very current at the moment, but as far as I'm concerned, the music part of it is over. Okay, it's still selling or whatever. But I'm thinking in terms of what I'm going to do next already. You know, it's just like it is like a sausage factory after a while, you know. It's like music, it's become that way. I mean, to me, it's just a... it's a packet of sausages, you know, and just marketed, and then I just want people to eat it, and that's it.
But you are then like a sausage company, improving the product. You're changing the product, yes, as the times change.
That's what most bands are. I mean, they can't harp on one album, you know. Otherwise, that would be it. You can't make one good album and say, okay, this is it. How much can you get out of one album? You know, okay, you can have it in your collection and sort of listen to it, but people want, you know, new stuff every day. And music is like that. And people do have to be very aware and change with the times and see what's going on. And I like to think that Queen's music does change with the times, and I know it does. I know it does. And I mean, it'd be awful to keep coming up with the same formula all the time. Number one, it would be boring for us, and I think it would be very boring for the public, and the press would have a field day. The press have a field day with us anyway.
And I don't think you would have stuck around for as long as you have.
No, I don't think so.
I must tell you, when I was in London the other day, and a taxi driver, I told him that I was going to come see you in Munich, and you're his favorite band. But he said he was so pissed off because he'd seen Duran Duran on some TV show, and they said, well, we're bigger than the Beatles. And he's going, God, who are these guys? You know, they've got three albums. Where do they think they're coming from?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes people get... I guess they're aiming high and things like that, and then they sort of... I mean, nobody's bigger than the Beatles. I mean, it's just something that's happened, and you just... I suppose, I mean, the Beatles will always be way to gauge yourself, because I mean, they're always a gauging point, you know, trying to be bigger than them. But I mean, it's just, you know, you have to sort of, to be bigger than them, or even to sort of come anywhere near something like the Beatles, you just have to sort of, it has to start from the very beginning. You've just got to sort of, I mean, like Michael Jackson now is in a way one of the biggest things going, because he sold more records than anybody else, and he's won all those awards and this and that. So that's, he's suddenly set a whole new precedent, you know, and that's what makes somebody huge and big. And that's the way it either happens very quickly earlier on, or forget it. I know Michael's been in the business a long time, but I mean, to a lot of people, he's a new artist, because he suddenly changed, and he's still only about 24, 25.
God, is he that young? Mm. That's amazing.
Makes you sick.
Makes me sick, too. Would you like to win a Grammy? Does that, the idea of that, turn you on at all?
It would be nice, but I mean, I'm not going to lose sleep over it. I'm not going to lose sleep over it, no. I'm quite happy the way I am at the moment, yeah.
Well, you always seem to have a good time, no matter what
you have to, otherwise, you know, I mean, I used to worry a lot, and I just don't worry about it anymore. I mean, it ages you, for a start. You don't need to worry, actually. I mean, I'm not saying I don't have any problems. Of course, everybody has problems. But I mean, I don't seem to worry about them so much as I used to before. You know, I used to be far more nervous than I am. You know, it's just so highly strung anyway. That I'm always going to be that. And no, I'm not worried about it. I mean, I just want to keep moving on.
What's made you be less nervous now?
Old age, I guess.
I prefer to think of it as maturity, Freddie.
I said that earlier on. No, I just, I'm more set in my ways now, and I'm just, I seem to be able to control things a bit better, and that doesn't mean just musically, it's the whole organization around me, you know, things and people in business, the people who work for me, everything. And maybe I just sort of said to myself that I know that there's always going to be problems, people always have problems, and I think... what happens is you try and overcome them. You try and overcome the obstacle. And then when you do that, and then there's always two in its place. So, I mean, I've just said to myself that there's always going to be, as far as in my profession and the way I live, there's always going to be problems, no matter what you do. So I just think, okay, I'll just take them as they come. So I've become more sort of complacent in as far as that's concerned, rather than worry about it. Otherwise, I'll just get worry myself to death.
If there's one underlying theme on this album, it seems to be kind of lamenting, sterile, machine kind of things and the way radio is getting, you know, that pops up a couple of times on the album. It's not.
I'm trying to think. Coming out the way this album is just. I don't think there's a concept in it at all. To be honest, it's just a bunch of songs that four people have written, and they happen to be on an album, and people have to try and make a concept out of it. And if there's a thread running through it, or if there's some sort of meaning, no, it's just a bunch of songs, and sometimes two or three songs seem to fall in one category. So people come out and say, okay, maybe they're doing... I know Machines and the clinical part of it is one aspect, but that's, I think, from Brian's point of view, because he's still guitar-oriented, and he write that way. As far as I write, just each song is different, you know. I just... I had a bunch of songs, and I just chose about three or four of them, and... they happen to be on the album. There's love ballads, and there's happy songs, and there's... I don't know. To be honest, I don't think there is any kind of concept that runs through it. It's just... All I know is it's just about every kind of song that you can get from Queen, and so we just threw them on the disc, and that's why we call it The Works, because it is The Works. I mean, we just tried every... You know, every possible... attack on every on every song that there was, and I think the works is a good title for it. Apart from that, I don't think there's any hidden meanings for anything.
Because it does seem to have things that are reminiscent of almost every phase of Queen, and you've gone through a lot of different phases. Because I was listening to the first couple albums.
I think after Hot Space, where we actually tried to channel ourselves in one direction, especially on the first side, we thought this time we would just leave it to our individual creativity, and what came out was a bunch of very different songs. And rather than try and group them and try and get a force of style out of them, like you were saying earlier, and make a concept of it, which Hot Space was more black orientated and things, we just said, no, we'll just let the songs do the things. That's the strength. And then we just had to group the songs together, basically. And we just thought, yeah, that's The Works. We just thought, it doesn't matter if a song is so totally out of concept. We're just going to put it on anyway because it's a Queen song.
How do you come up with the songs? Is everybody writing all the time?
Yeah, it's very it's quite competitive now, even just within the band. Fucking hell! I mean, it's like it's before it even gets out to the public, and then it's competitive with all the other bands that are around. I mean, it starts off being competitive within the group because I mean they're four. Four good writers, and they're equally sort of adept at doing things, and they're no passengers. So I mean, and especially now Roger's writing very well, and so is John. And so because Brian and I used to be the principal writers, now I think we all write the same. And so there's a good fight right at the start, and we just basically come out with our own ideas and present it to each other and just say, okay, you know, what do you think? And then the fighting starts. I mean, if we don't like it, we just... I seem to participate more on, say, John's or Roger's tracks. I mean, they let me help them and suggest more things. Brian's got his own sort of writing ideas, and they're very sort of strong to start with anyway. So, I mean, he's just... I don't seem to be able to get into his ideas so much. But in a way, that's quite good. I'd rather leave it to him, and it doesn't mean I just stay out of it altogether. I let him sort of do a lot of it, whereas in John's songs or Roger's songs, I mean, I sort of get in there at quite an early stage, and they sort of, you know, they don't mind me sort of tearing it apart and sort of piecing it back together again.
Lyrically speaking, you mean?
Every way.
You do.
Sometimes I take the whole song over. Like, I don't mind saying it. It's just like Radio Gaga. I just instantly felt that there was something. There was going to be something, you know. You could build that into a really good, a strong, saleable commodity. And I think Roger was just thinking of it as just another track. And I just said, no, I think it needs. So I virtually took it over, and I sent him on he went on a holiday, a skiing holiday for about a week, and came back. And I virtually, but it's basically his song. You know, he had the ideas there together, and I just felt that there was, you know, some construction elements in there that were wrong to start with, and he just said, okay, you do what you want. And
that's the first biggie for Roger, isn't it?
Hit. Yeah, oh, definitely, yeah. He wanted that very badly, and I think he deserves it, yeah. It's a big hit in the Europe places.
So that's part one. We're listening to an interview with Freddie Mercury, and it's pretty amazing. We're going to play the rest of it. because the whole thing is fascinating. I don't know. Anita, what stood out for you? I mean, he's talking about the album that they had just done, which had just come out, which was called The Works. And he's talking about his solo album. And
well, the solo album, yeah. The solo album is kind of sad because, you know, he describes it as one thing and it didn't end up that way. Michael Jackson, it never ended well with Michael Jackson. Freddie hated the llama and Michael hated Freddie's drug use. And it just wasn't going to happen. But it's just so funny that Michael Jackson was put off by Freddie Mercury's drug use. It's, you know, it's a little ironic. And the fact that he had the llama in the studio and Freddie couldn't stand it, it's comical. It really is. But yeah, that it didn't happen. The solo album, Mr. Bad Guy, was almost called Made in Heaven. And I think that's what the posthumous album was called, right?
Yeah. Although I think in the interview here, and I don't remember which, he talks the solo album was called Solo Album.
Well, it came out in 85, but they remixed and reissued it in 2019.
Right.
And I love that he dedicated it to his cats.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah.
So we're going to play the next part. This is part two of our interview with Freddie Mercury, unedited, just as it happened.
It would be true to say, wouldn't it, that audiences, both at concerts and radio audiences in different countries, like different things, don't they?
Of course. It would be so boring if everybody liked the same song.
Well, you know, in the United States, though, it's so big, but a top 40 single that's number one in New York is almost sure to be a top 40 single in L.A., too.
Because that's the Americans. The Americans. I mean you're talking about the whole world. I mean, about Japanese culture and the way the Germans consume product. It's all very different, yeah. Sometimes it does amaze me where if you write a song which is a good song and it sells in, say, three-quarters of the market, I'm dumbfounded to find out why sometimes it doesn't sell at all in something like America. I mean, Mull of Kintyre, which is a Paul McCartney song, was one of the biggest hits in England. I mean, it is the biggest single ever written. I mean, it's the biggest selling single in England, Mull of Kintyre. It sold over 2 million or something like that. And it was never even released in America in that way, because he just felt, or the company or whatever, felt immediately that it wasn't going to be. So they turned the thing around. Sure, I'm right. And they got the B side of that, and the A side in America. I'm sure McCartney was pissed off.
I'm sure he was too.
Phoebe! Want some more wine? More wine!
You co-wrote a song with Brian on this album?
I know. There should be an eclipse. That was a very... I liked the way we actually approached that song, because it was a... we were looking at all the songs we had, and we thought that we were... The one thing that we didn't have was one of those real limpid ballads. Or the lilting type, you know, the Love of My Life type things. And rather than sort of... one of us saying, okay, I'm going to go back and do it. Go back and think about it and write it. I just said, Brian, why don't we just think of something right here? And that song just evolved in about 2 days. He just got an acoustic and I just sat next to him and we just worked it out together. And I like it. That's why it's sparse. And the other thing is also, we only had like a couple of days to go to the tail end of the project, and we had to get the album released. It was a deadline, and that kind of pressure sort of helped, and I came up with the lyrical side, and then he came up with the chords, and something just happened, and it's the first time. Yeah, we never ever see. If we actually thought beforehand and said, okay, you know, Brian and I should sit down and write a song together, I don't think it would have ever happened, because I mean, then all kinds of the egos would have played havoc to start with, and who does what, and this way we didn't have time to think about it. We just sort of went in there. Got it together. And if it didn't work, we were going to throw it out, and it seemed to work, and it was sort of quite strong. And we said, "Yeah, this should work very well as a tail end of the album."
I would have guessed that Brian wrote the lyrics,
and that you. Well, did honey, I did.
You altruistic little thing, you.
That's the way it is. It's sort of. Well, they sound like Brian's things. They're sort of more in-depth, and I know it sounds like that, but I can come up with those too. It's just something that... No, I mean, I wouldn't like to say that I wrote it all. Brian had I know he was there, but I remember that I most of the lyrics on that song are mine. Yes, but I mean Brian did help with the line here and there. I mean, if he wrote them, I would say yes.
Are lyrics important to you, or are they disposable also?
They're very important to me, and the fact that they're very hard. I find them very difficult, and I sometimes feel that I always feel my melodies are much stronger, and then I find that my lyrics seem to sort of bring the song down. So I have to really work hard at my lyrics to sort of bring the standard up, and. I wish I was Elton John and had Bernie Taupin to write all my lyrics sometimes, but no, I like to write them myself. I find them very difficult. They're the most difficult thing for me.
Speaking of Elton, another good friend of yours, were you as shocked as the rest of the world his marriage?
Same here, yeah.
On Valentine's Day?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, just funny thing is I haven't talked to him since he got married. So I mean, I wonder what's up his sleeve.
Well, Connie Pappas Hillman says that he wants very much to have children.
A baby. I know. That's what I remember him saying something like that. And I said something like that. If you want babies, you just go to Harrods and buy one. I did.
That's right, from the cradle to the grave. Isn't that their slogan?
What?
That you can get anything at Harrods from the cradle
virtually,
to the grave.
Yeah, you can get an elephant there. Whatever. Exactly, that's what I meant. It's just, if you buy two, you can have a nanny thrown in. No, but I haven't. He seems to be very happy. Maybe he does. Maybe he just want children and that's it.
Do you write your songs on guitar or piano?
Well, these days, basically, I just write them in my head, to be honest. Yeah, I don't. Otherwise, basically, piano, yeah. The guitar part is over. I mean, I thought the odd time I can. Crazy little thing was about the last song that I ever wrote on a guitar. I'm so limited with guitar chords. Sometimes that's a good thing. That's why I liked Crazy Little Thing the same way. If I knew too many guitar chords, then I'd sort of ruin them. But otherwise, it's piano. But most of the time, I sort of conjure up things in my head now. And then I go to either synthesizer or whatever and just play it out. Or go to a drum box, you know, just get a drum machine and get that. It's a different way of writing now, you know. My whole way of writing is very different. Before I used to sit on, maybe I should do that, before I used to sit on the piano and sort of really work my ass off to just get the whole chords and the whole construction before I actually got some sort of theme into a song. Now it's a different way of thinking. I just don't like sort of doing that. I just want all the ideas to come in my head and then they come out. It's a different way of writing because I just feel that if they're not in my head, then they're not worth putting down. So rather than, but then afterwards I have to work, you know. I mean, then I have to piece it apart. But I like things to happen far much more quickly these days than before. Before I was quite willing to sort of come back to it another day and said, okay, I remember these few chords from last night. Let's do it again. No, I'd rather that the whole piece came together in the first session. Otherwise, forget it. I'd try something else. Yes, there's so many different things you can try these days.
Synthesizer seems to be playing a bigger and bigger part in you.
Very much so. You can get so many. That's why, I mean, I don't know half the things that most people know about synthesizers, but I'm trying to learn, because especially for the solo album, I want to do everything myself. So, I mean, I want to make sure the things that, say Brian did, like a guitar orchestra, I can actually, if I wanted that, I can recreate on synthesizers and things like that. And basically, I think I'm going to actually get a chance to do things on my solo album which I virtually wouldn't want to do with Queen, because I mean, say something like a drum pattern, I mean, Roger would always do that for me on a Queen album, but on my solo album I actually want to do it myself, so I can actually, I want to program the drum machine myself and things like that, so that I feel I'm doing things that it is a new area for me, and I'm actually going to try and do things that I never did with Queen before, so that'll be a first.
This Fairlight machine is pretty fascinating, isn't it?
It's beyond me, to be honest, but there are people that can work it, and I think in the end it just goes it's a bit too far. I mean, gadgets are one thing. In the end, you've got to come up with a song. They can't write the song for you. I mean, they help a lot. I mean, they come up with wonderful sounds and wonderful sort of things which can stimulate you and say, oh, that's a good sound, let's use it. But they don't write a song. You can program it to death. I mean, it can't write a song. And basically, sometimes you can get stuck in all these technicalities and ruin a song. I write to sort of, I like the idea that they're around, but I mean, you've got to be careful how you use them. Yeah. I basically like to think that I write, if I can write a good song, that's enough, and the gadgets come later.
The solo album is a big challenge for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I waited this long, and I think I better do it now before I lose it all. It's just, it's a high point this year. Once that's done, it's over, and I'll go back to doing Queen stuff. But I've deliberately taken a bit of time off to do this, because, I mean, if I do this project, I'm going to do it properly. I don't want to sort of... You know, before, a few years ago, I wanted to do it then, but I didn't have the time, and I could have sort of rushed it. I really don't want to rush it. I just want to do it in the way that I feel, and now the time is right. And while I sit here in Munich, it's just the beginning of my solo project.
Have you been writing songs for it for years, or...?
No. I've thought about it. I mean, I just write songs, and at that time, all my songs were for Queen, and... Well, there are lots of songs that haven't sort of been on Queen albums, and I can sort of go through, you know, delve into the barrel and see what's there. But I mean, the funny thing is, in the moment I write songs, and then if they're not used, they're virtually discarded, if you know what I mean. Because I just feel that if they weren't used then, they're not good enough. But sometimes some of the best songs are left behind, and if you sort of, it's just knowing if they're good for the time or whatever. At the moment, I just want to write everything that's totally new and sparkling. And I remember, I mean, Roger was saying that I have a batch of songs that weren't used. I mean, I could put them on an album and make a solo album out of those. But it would be awful. It would all be rejected material, as it were. And I want to come up with very fresh material that's actually me at the moment.
Are you going to produce yourself, or will Mac do it?
Well, Mac will do it with me, yeah.
You wouldn't, even on Queen albums, it's pretty much a collaboration, isn't it, between the band and Mac?
Mm-hmm.
I guess by now you pretty much know each other's ways, though.
Yeah, Mac is, especially for me, is a very integral part. I mean, he just seems to know exactly what I want without telling him. And that is good. That sort of, you know, you can gain a lot of time by that. Rather than, so the moment sometimes when I just go into a studio and he knows I work very fast. And I get very... I get disillusioned and I get bored very quickly if it's not happening. So he knows the moment I go in there, when things are happening, the tape's running and he's already got all the all his EQ together, all the sounds together. And he knows that if I come back and I say, oh my God, you haven't got a sound together, I'll get bored. So he knows me. So it's a very... I like this partnership with him. I do. I think more so than the others. He helps me a lot, because I mean, I'm not just very good, so I mean, he really helps me in that way. I just like to go in there and do the musical part of it, totally, just the creative part, and he does all the rest.
So that's part two of our interview with Freddie Mercury. I think we're just going to move into to part three, because I mean, I'm still riveted about this, and this is where he talks about the steps in making an album again with the solo projects. And in fact, I think he even says in this one where if the solo album comes out, he could see Queen playing his solo stuff. But of course, we'll never know. That never happened. So here is part three of our interview done in Munich, Germany with Freddie Mercury.
So what's the first step then in the making of an album after the songs are written?
Well, you've got to record them properly with a good sound. So that's
right. A backing track wise, though.
Yeah, and you just got to get a good backing track, you know, get a good backing track, and then you just got to piece the song together. And then when you do the overdubs, you've got to make sure you do the right overdubs. You can do too many overdubs sometimes, and it's basically... I hate... Before we used to have the sifting process where we used to have a song and we used to just put everything on it and then find out what worked. I hate doing it, and that's like putting the kitchen sink on it and then actually sort of peeling things off which didn't work. That's the long way of going about it. You know, now I like to feel that I know what's going to work. Which is, I mean, it comes through experience. And I know, and I just say, okay, this is... And you have to make decisions. So I just feel, okay, this is going to be right. And we do it. And then we just shift it around a little. And then you say, okay, yes, this is it. There's so many various ways of writing a song. I mean, you can just go on forever and say, okay, I'm going to try this, I'm going to try this, I'm going to try this. But then sometimes you can really ruin a song because you've tried so many different things, you don't know what to sort of what's it going to end up with. You know, you have to, decisions is a focal point. You know, you just have to. I mean, there's so many. you can decide at various intervals. You can either decide very early on that the song's going to turn out this way, or you can change your mind the next day and say, okay, I'm going to change. A whole song can change overnight. And so you've just got to be very strong and make a decision and say, this is how it's going to stand, and stop here, and that's it.
When you're on the road, songs do change overnight, though, don't they? I mean, I would think you must be awfully tired of playing Bohemian Rhapsody by now.
Well, I am a bit, actually, but no, it's, when you're talking about stage presentation, that's a whole different kettle of fish, because, in a funny way, I like the fact that the songs do change, because it would be awful to I hate this thing about trying to recreate your albums on stage. A lot of people come up to me sometimes and say, oh, yeah, they sound just like the album, but they don't. I know they don't. We sometimes deliberately change our songs to so that they have a different... I think our songs do change drastically. You can make so much out of it. Look at Love of My Life, for instance. I mean, you know, on record, that is... It's got all kinds of different things. I play piano on that. On stage, it's just Brian playing the guitar and me singing it. It's just got a whole total... new look on that, because it works on stage much better that way.
Do you consider how a sound is going to come across on stage?
Before we write it? No, yeah. Not at all. No, we just write. We write for the studio. We write a song, and we put things on it so that it sounds the best for the record. We don't think about how it's going to sound on stage, because I mean that would be limiting the actual song. I mean you've just got to give the song what it needs. The full quota just for the studio, because I mean that's what people are going to hear it that way. And then when if we think it needs changing for stage adaptation, then you just do that. You just change it for stage. I don't think stage the actual sort of stage presentation should come into it at the recording stage, because then that can ruin a song.
How do you guys decide on virtually anything? There are four of you. Does majority rule, or does everybody have to agree?
No, sometimes, yeah. In the end, yeah, so majority does rule, yeah. We do. In the end, what can you do, you know? But, I mean, there'll be either... Well, sometimes you have two and two. What do you do then? I think you just keep it going until somebody falters and goes the other way. Basically, it is like that. I think whoever speaks loudest in the end, or whose throat... You know, whoever keep going wins. Sometimes... I know sometimes John just says, oh, God, I can't take it. Just make your decision. I don't care. I'll just go along with the rest. Sometimes that happens, you know. And,
Who's around most during the recording process?
Nobody.
I've noticed.
I'll tell you who's around most. It's Mac. Poor Mac, because he's the co-producer, and he has to be there for all the songs. I mean, sometimes... And I do find that can be... It must be very taxing for him, because there are times where I've had enough. I can just go away for a couple of days, knowing fully well that the others are going to be doing their stuff. Mac has to be there all the time to make sure it's still on tape. So I guess he's there most of the time. In fact, he is there. I know he's there most of the time, otherwise it just doesn't get done. But you do, you know, as creative people and all that, you do need a breather, you know. You sometimes have to get away and get out of this whole thing and look at it in perspective. It's like having a paint, you know, doing a painting. I mean, if you're so involved, you just have to give it a rest sometimes. And with me, I know that I find that if I keep dwelling on one project for too long, I ruin it. I know I ruin it. So I just keep going. I know that I have to finish it as quickly as possible. Otherwise, I discard it and start with something else.
So it's sort of like your first instinct is right.
That's the way I go about it. I like it like it's like a newly laid, fresh egg. You know, I just... because there's so many ways of writing a song. I mean, you can just come up and just... I write very quickly as well, and that's part of it. I mean, and so I sort of utilize that. I work on that, and... you know, these days I just go into a studio and just get there, and I have a few ideas in my head, and the last... A couple of weeks, what I've been doing is I've just been going to the studio totally with a blank, with no ideas at all, and Max sets me all these tasks. He just says, okay, try and write something with this tempo. So he works out the thing on just a total drum machine, and I have to sort of say, okay, it's like a project every day, and I have to finish it by the end of the evening. You know, I don't mean the total finished product, but an overall idea of what a song should be like. And I've been doing that, and it's worked out quite well. You listen to some of them.
A goal, right? You set yourself
it's
a goal.
Yes. I think that's good. Rather than say, okay, knowing fully well that you have like 3 months or something, you can come back to it. No, I just say, look, I've got to finish the thing today, otherwise it's not worth it. And it's a challenge. It's a very big challenge, but I like doing it that way, on spec. So I go in there totally not knowing what's going to happen, and suddenly, you know, I let Mike do give me the sort of the challenge. He says, okay, today write one with this tempo or something like that, or write, or he just tells me, he says, write something in this mode, so I don't have to think about it beforehand, and I just let my creative juices run havoc.
But just a tad of discipline on the side.
I've got to discipline myself. But it's wonderful, because sometimes the greatest things happen because you're not limiting yourself. You're not thinking, oh, a certain song has got to be written in this way. Because sometimes you say, okay, I'm going to sit down and try and think of, well, what kind of song do I want to write? I want to write one with a heavy content. And the moment you start thinking that way, you're already limiting yourself because you're thinking, okay, it's got to be heavy. I just go in there and just... Sometimes if you're writing something... Two or three songs can happen, because I mean you're not limiting yourself, you're going from one side to another, and you think, my God, this is crazy. But out of all that, you got say a minute or even 30 seconds of something that is worthwhile. You lift that out and suddenly say, okay, I'm going to keep going with that, and out comes a song.
How far along are you on the solo project? How much is done?
Well, very little as far as I'm concerned. Basically, I've just got ideas. And I think I've got some very good songs, but now I've got to sort of... I still want to go into the studio and do what I said before, just go in there and start creating. And then I want like at least 15 songs that are running around, and then I'm just going to pick ones that I really want to work on.
You know, I would have guessed, just from having watched you perform so much, that you love performing more than recording, but now I'm getting the drift that you really dig it in the studio too.
It goes in phases. I like doing studio work, as long as it doesn't take too long. And most Queen albums take a hell of a long time, and I get really bored. Now that my solo project's coming up, I know I'm the one to blame if it takes long or whatever. But I mean, I'm setting my own deadline and things like that. So it's going to be fun. I'm not going to have the others to sort of sometimes. We can bog each other down, you know. If things aren't finished, you go, oh, my God. But this time, it's just going to be me, so I'm going to be able to actually, for the first time, set my own principles, do my own deadline, and work with that. Maybe it's harder than I think.
Time will tell. Yeah. Do you have a title yet?
No, I think because I've had these rough cassettes and... The engineer seemed to write, you know, Freddie Mercury solo. And over the days, I've been looking at them, and I thought, that might be okay, just solo at the moment. So Freddie Mercury goes solo. Well, it's to the point, and it's saying what I'm doing. So at the moment, I could call it solo. Otherwise, I think of something a bit more wonderful.
Would you have any aspirations at all of making a tour without Queen?
What would I do? I can't come. I'd have to have a backing band.
You'd have to have somebody behind a curtain.
Yeah. No. I think at the moment all I'm thinking about is just coming up with a solo album. And as far as touring, oh no way, no. I love touring with Queen because I mean I have so much fun. It's like we all have our individual solo projects all working anyway when we tour. So I mean it's. I think, and the way I think, I mean, if it ever happens, is if I do my solo album and then we go on tour, I mean, I think Queen would do some of my solo songs anyway.
Mm.
So, I mean, they would just be recreating what I did in the studio anyway, in their way. And so that would be quite good. They would sort of take it a stage further. They would be doing my songs. I mean, in a way, that's what happens now anyway. We all have little solo projects within the band anyway, as you know, and we all just play on them. So as far as that's concerned, no, I don't have any aspirations of going on stage without them.
Is Fred Mandel becoming pretty much of a
yes,
fifth member?
No, I wouldn't say he's a fifth. At the moment, he's working with Elton John all the time. You know, oh. He's got like a year's contract. He's a very good musician, and as far as stage work is concerned, he's an integral part, and we'd hate to lose him. But if if he's not there, we'll have somebody else do this. He just does all the synthesized parts and the odd piano things, but he's very, very good.
But also that gives you, that frees you those piano
that.
Parts.
I mean, oh, I love that.
Yes, how
love
could
that.
A person keep do what you do without stopping?
No, but I mean, he doesn't just take over my piano part. I mean, he actually adds to the songs. I mean, because we were losing out. I mean, especially now that we're doing a lot of synthesized work on albums, there was no one else to do it, because I mean, I can't do all that and play the piano and sing and run around, and it was a bit too much. I mean, you know, somewhere along the line, you know, something was going to, you know, there was this limiting thing, and we needed another musician to actually do those parts, because everybody else is just doing so many things all at the same time. And I wanted a bit of freedom to actually be on front of the stage, because I felt a lot of the times I was just sitting at a piano stool, and I don't mind doing that for the odd song, but I just don't like being restricted so much. And I wanted to actually sort of sing the song and deliver the song while actually being on front stage. And Fred Mandel helps a lot that way. He takes over a lot of the synthesized parts. And if it's not Fred Mandel, it'll be somebody else.
How long has it been since your last tour? Phoebe and I were just talking about how it's hard to keep track of one year to the next. You know, was it's been?
I think it's been something like over two years.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, because I was talking to Bryn last night, and she said, "Well, I've been gone for a year, and she's lived in New York for a year, and it was well before that." You remain in amazing shape. You know, I've always been an admirer of your body.
Well, it's sort of it's still there. It's still there. I say I'm working out and doing things like that. You know, it's just I haven't worked out for about a month or so. It's so hard for somebody like me to have a routine for that kind of thing. I wish my work, my career only took place in, say, one area, that way, then I could really get into a routine. All these people with wonderful bodies, they get into a routine. They stay in one place, they have a job that goes from 9 to 5 or whatever, and then they can go into the gym and work out for 2 hours, and then there's a cycle. So, I mean, you can, and that's what, to keep a, but for me, I'm suddenly in Germany one week, then I'm in London or whatever, and I just, it's, you know, I'm flying. I mean, I wish I had a set of weights in a plane, to be honest. So, I mean, I have to sort of take that into consideration, and I take it from there. But otherwise, I like to keep fit.
So that's part three of our interview with Freddie Mercury. You're hearing the whole thing here on the Rock Podcast. We didn't edit it or chop it up, and you're hearing it just as it happened. So I'm still like, whoa. Part four is coming up. And just to show you that we didn't want to touch anything, they start talking about they must have stopped the interview and they had to go to a wedding. So I don't know when they picked up the interview again, but the interview will note that. And
when you say they, you're talking about Mary Turner, who is the interviewer for this incredible interview. And she interviewed everyone.
Everybody. She was one of the greatest interviewers.
Yeah, she really was. And just such a friendly, beautiful person inside and out. You know, I don't know anybody that wasn't attracted to her on some level.
So here it is, part four. Our interview with Freddie Mercury.
Okay, well, just to set the scene here, we've now been to a wedding.
Yeah.
Now we're in an apartment upstairs from the wedding.
That's great. That's Munich. Actually, I mean, I know nobody. I would never get to do things like that. Over here, they seem to look after me quite well.
I wanted to ask you about that, because I know many cities in the States, you're a very recognizable figure, and it's kind of hard for you to walk down
the
street.
Well, I mean, yes, over here, I think they're very cool over here, believe it or not. I mean, it's like Munich is like a village. After a while, I've been here for so long, and after a while, they just sort of, you know, take it into consideration that I'm around, and they don't really pester me at all. They don't.
Is that ever a problem in your life, big cities, or do you kind of dig it?
I dig it. Yeah. Not anymore. It's just those days of women throwing themselves in front of me and tearing my hair out and all that is over now. Culture Club are getting that now, so it's just, it comes and goes. I mean, you know, wouldn't it be awful if people are still sort of, say, doing that? You have to grow up. I'm not saying that we don't have a young generation of people that buy our records, it's just that they just accept us as being, you know, established, and it's a different kind of thing. To be honest, I'd hate it anyway if people still started doing that. It's wonderful to actually have to go through all that. Everybody needs that. And we had all our, you know, we had those crazy scenes in Japan the first time we went there, and all these screaming girls at airports trying to sort of run you down and things. All that's
Yeah, and the late, the last time it happened was in South America, and where we had to go in armored cars and things like that. It's so
that was like Beatlemania. That was crazy.
Yeah, it was just But I like to think I can walk around anywhere without people if they recognize me. They basically just come up and say hello and ask me sort of intelligent questions these days, whereas before it was, you know, why do you still wear black nail varnish and why only on the left hand and things? Well, it's just, you have to grow up.
It's interesting that you mention Culture Club because I am struck when looking at them, not that you ever wore a dress or anything that I know of. You guys were that flamboyant when you started. You had Sandra Rhodes clothes. And
I think that happens. It's like a cycle. Somebody else has to take over. I remember saying that to somebody. It's exactly the same. It's just that it's a different time, and people are saying, oh, isn't he so outrageous? I mean, we were outrageous at that time. I mean, look at David Bowie when he started up and Roxy Music. I mean, we all have, you know, there's always, you have to start. I mean, the Beatles in their day were totally outrageous. I mean, with that long hair, in those days, people weren't, they weren't used to that. And now you're getting this sort of very androgynous. I mean, even I was androgynous when I started off. I mean, this is really into the sort of transvestite factor or whatever. But I mean, I think Boy George is a very, I think he's very, very good.
He really is good.
Yeah, I think he's talented and he knows what he's doing. And it's just that he's aware. When people start off these days, I mean, they have all in their belt. They've grown up with all their breeding is all the stuff that we've done before, you know, and so they have all that under their belt. And so it's, to me, I think it's quite outrageous what he's doing. But I mean, I can see that that's the way he's starting off at this point, and he's just taking all that. He's just done his homework, and he thinks that's the norm as far as he's concerned.
It's sort of second generation, isn't it?
I mean, it really is, yeah. It was sort of, it is second generation. It's just that they're a new band, and there's another generation of people taking on to them being new.
You were probably his influence.
We are friends, and he used to sort of say that he used to come to some of our shows, and there was one party we had a hat party at Legends about 4 years ago, and he said he gatecrashed it with Marilyn. I mean, you heard about Marilyn.
Mm-hmm.
He said, of course, you didn't know me then, but I mean, we just wore hats and gatecrashed it, and that's what he was saying. I said, oh my God, how things have changed. You know, and a couple of years after that, he just become a phenomenal star. There you go. Good luck.
You're a flamboyant person anyway, but is the Freddie Mercury that we see on stage pretty much the real Freddie Mercury?
Well, it is me. I mean, it is me doing it, but it's just that I don't like to sort of, the theatrics I get, basically that's what you're talking about, the theatrics I get up to on stage are me doing my job, you know. I mean, I hate being still, and this is the way I get into it. That doesn't mean that every day when I go about in the streets or whatever that I'm like that. No, I'm just sort of, I'm basically quite a shy person, really, when I get down to it. But I mean, I can be a real bitch as well. I just let my characters loose at the right time, you know. It's just I don't have to sort of play the key role all the time. That's just, you know, it's just the way I am. And I don't worry about the fact that if I'm suddenly in someone's front room or something, I don't have to sort of suddenly play the key role. I mean, I just take it as it comes.
You just showed me the new video.
Yeah.
You're definitely an actor.
That's the first. Well, I think we were all acting there. I mean, it was just the first time we were put in these roles. And see, a lot of the times people make videos and expect musicians or whatever to sort of play a certain role and do acting. I mean, that's where it falls down. I mean, a lot of times where we've shied away from that so that we don't look. Sometimes, I mean, if you go into a little acting thing, I mean, you've just got to do it really well. And if you don't do it well, then it just comes across as really crass. I mean, it's like musicians trying to act and because they want to do a video, you know. You just got to be very careful. And this time, because of the fun element and the comedy element, I mean, I think it worked because we just put ourselves, it's so farcical. And it's the first time that a whole, well, I know the Stones did it a long time ago, dressed up in drag, but I don't think they did a video. But I can't think of any other video where the four, you know, the four principals, as it were, are actually doing real comedy drag. And also from the standpoint that a lot of times Queen come across as very serious. I mean, the music ability is always there, but I mean, we've always been humorous underneath, but maybe it doesn't come across through songs or whatever, and on stage we're very, very aggressive or whatever, and the humor element is always lost. And this time it was a good way of showcasing that bit, and I think we suddenly found that we could actually do it quite well. It was just that we were sort of maybe restricting ourselves, thinking that we couldn't do it. This time we said, oh, fuck it, we're just going to do it and go crazy. And we all sort of built our own characters around each sort of, you know, drag individual. I seem to cope quite well. I've never worn high heels before. I mean, I've never done a...
Well, I love your garters.
All that, yes. So believe it or not, I mean, a lot of people doing, what's it like, even saying... New Orleans Mardi Gras or whatever, or even just a Halloween party or something. Never dressed up in drag. I don't know why. When I kept the moustache on, so... I don't know. I just had more fun doing that. I think we all had more fun doing that because it was just... We're letting ourselves go a bit. And we're not so worried about how we're going to depict the musical element, because we're always worried about that in videos. And this time we just said... We'll just do it. And I think it came across very well. I hope people like it.
It's wonderful. Did it pain you to... you kept your mustache on for the drag parts, but you took it off.
Because we suddenly went into a... I've always wanted to do this Nijinsky role, as it were, but I just wanted to wear the costume because I didn't want to dance like him. Like, I couldn't, ever. It's just that... I always wanted to wear this L'Après-Midi Dauphin costume, which is a... Working with the Royal Ballet, I thought I must do it properly. Anyway, you know, I mean, I could have kept my moustache on, but that would have then taken another comedy element as well. I just wanted it sort of a bit more serious at that level, especially if you're dancing with, you know, real professionals. And I think that was another thing I've always wanted to do, so there you are. Two in one video.
But you really pull it off. I mean, you really do look like a real
dancer.
Well,
I did my best, yeah. I'm just... they teach you a lot, you know. I mean, they sort of... One of the principal ballet dancers from the Royal Ballet, Wayne Eagling, I mean, he's been a friend of mine from a long time. He sort of taught me how to do things, and if I couldn't do them, I mean, he taught me how to cheat as well in certain things, and a lot of things were very difficult, but I just tried them all. I'm willing to try everything.
So the Royal Ballet, I suppose, they don't just appear in any old buddy's video.
They're friends of yours, eh? Yeah, so, I mean, because a long time ago, about 4 years ago, they asked me to do a charity gala. Which they had, so it was all the donations went to charity, and they just wanted me to. This is when I actually did it at Covent Garden, and they wanted me to sing Bohemian Rhapsody but dance at the same time, which has never been done. So I mean, but then they choreographed a routine for me, and I'm the thing as they did. They had me upside down right at the end. That I was in a shape of a cross, and it sort of levered me. Down, and I was still singing the finishing passages of Bohemian Rhapsody. God, it was that was very nerve-wracking. But since then, I became friends, and so I thought maybe we could use them in a little passage for this video.
Doesn't looking at this and seeing that you can do it, that it looks fine, make you want to maybe think about movies or something like that, acting anyway?
I mean, it's yeah, a lot of people have asked me that. I mean, it's just the way it is. I mean, if I want to do it, I'm going to do it properly. And at the moment, I just I'm a little scared of it. I mean, I feel that number one, the solo album is coming out, and well, I'm going to do the solo album, and I'm going to put all my energies to that at the moment. And then when the time is right, maybe I'll do it. Yeah, I certainly haven't discarded the idea altogether. It's just something that if it comes at the right time, then yes. A lot of things I'm doing at the moment is also trying to work with other people. And after having worked with David Bowie and things, I mean, the Michael Jackson project, which might never come to fruition, but I mean, we've sort of started on it. But then also, I mean, I quite like writing for, like, say, different films and things. I mean, a lot of people have actually approached me to write for film. I mean, at the moment, there's one idea that's just, I don't know whether it'll ever come up, is they've asked me to write the title track and another song for the new Conan movie, which has got Arnold Schwarzenegger and Grace Jones. Well, I love Grace Jones, and they said that I could either write a song for her, and I'd love to do that. So I mean, that's whether that comes off, those kind of things. So it's just like sidestepping a little. It's just doing things outside the Queen idiom, which is good. I like doing that now. I want to do that. Otherwise, I mean, I'd just be, you know, I just don't want people to remember me as being just part of Queen. I want them to remember me as doing other things as well.
Do you think there's ever a time when people become, you know, too old to rock and roll?
I think that's true, yes.
I mean,
I don't think I've quite reached it. I mean, the moment, I don't think it's the fact of being too old to rock and roll. I think you can jig and dance about it as long as you want. It's when you, I just feel it's, if you find there comes a time where your records aren't selling as much, and I'd hate to do a downward tread, if you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly still keep going as Queen, doing, say, the lesser venues. I mean, now that I've tasted the top whack, I mean, I would hate to suddenly think that, okay, we can't fill, say, certain auditoriums. I'd just leave them and do something else, still maintaining the Queen thing, rather than keep going back and say, okay, you played, we played, say, Madison Square Gardens, say, four times in a row every time we do it. If suddenly we go back and we realize that we can only, say, do one show, I don't think I'd like to do that. I'd like to do something totally different. I'd rather go as Queen and do a very small club or something. So it's different. Going and doing Madison Square Garden once, because you can't sell it out more than three times, would be a downward step. I don't want to do that. It's Yeah, yeah.
Get out on
Yeah,
top.
But basically, in the end, we're here to sell records. So it doesn't. To be honest, I don't care where I play. In the end, it's the records. And if the records, okay, one album didn't sell as much as the last, that doesn't matter. But if there was a sort of, if you just felt inside you that, you know, the records weren't selling, you have to just do it in a different way.
Nobody is a better critic than oneself.
You're dead right. But sometimes you have to sort of be very honest with yourself. And sometimes a lot of people want to keep going at it. And I know, as far as I'm concerned, my own personal character is that I just couldn't do. I mean, I want the best. And if I've reached a certain goal and I certainly can't maintain that, I'll just get out of it and do something else rather than keep, you know, it's just, I don't want to end up like Gloria Swanson, you know, you just have to move.
I was trying to think different of a rock and roll example, and Jerry Lee Lewis came to mind, but shit, he plays great.
Yeah,
still.
Sure.
And then I recalled that I had just gotten an 8x10 glossy of Gary Glitter last week, and you would die. This guy's big old fat blimp.
Yeah. Oh, well. Oh.
and still trying, you know, give me a break.
Well, that's the way it is. I was just, I mean, you know, rock and rollers can keep rocking. It just doesn't mean you have to keep doing in the same idiom. You can start doing them. I feel we have, Queen have enough intelligence and creativity to do very different things. And that's why moving on to, say a musical thing. I mean, I'd love to write a musical one day, you know. But, I mean, that time can come. When my legs give up and I can't do my stage work, I can do it then. It's that kind of thing I'm thinking. I just don't want to, I don't want to sort of end up doing, you know, thinking, hoping that people, remember me as just being somebody who wrote songs and carried on and did shows. I think, but to force yourself to do things is different. It's just, when the time comes and when it's right, then that's the best time to do it.
You wouldn't be happy just doing nothing, would you? Because obviously you have enough money and financial resources.
Oh, exactly, no. I don't. No way could I stay at home and sort of keep wiping my gold discs and platinum discs and saying, oh, what a wonderful person I was at the time. You know, no. Oh, no. Even when I get to 40 and 45 or whatever, I'll be doing different things that keep me, because you've got to keep yourself stimulated. You've just got to keep yourself, and there are so many different things that keep me stimulated. So, I mean, it doesn't have to just be Queen all the time. At the moment, I mean, the last 10 years or whatever, there's so much within Queen that wanted me, that kept my adrenaline going, that I wanted to do it. And now that's why it's taken me, people from the very onset have been saying, oh, when is your solo album going to come out? A lot of people sort of burn themselves out too quickly and go, right, I mean, I just didn't feel I wanted a solo project at the time. Now the time has come. Right, after 10 years, after 13 years, it's come, and I really do want to do a solo project. I really feel that I want to do something on my own, but that doesn't mean I discard Queen altogether. It's still there. It's just I'm sidestepping a little and doing that, and through that might come all kinds of other things, you know. And like you say about acting, you never know. I might suddenly see this role that's offered to me or whatever, and I'm just saying, okay, well, I can take it. But if I do that, then I'll make sure I make a good job at it, or I'll do my best at any rate. I'm not going to do it half measures.
That's part four of our interview with Freddie Mercury. We got one more segment to come up. What do you think now?
Well, you know, he just keeps revealing more and more of himself. You know, I was shocked to hear him say, I don't know exactly what point he was talking about it, about the Radio Gaga story. You know, he says he worked on it with Roger. And by the end of the story, he pretty much says without yeah, she doesn't,
I noticed that.
She
I
doesn't noticed try that. To get yeah. this out of him. This is just something that he, you know, well, I did the whole thing.
Yeah,
I and that must have been maddening for the other members in the band.
Well, that really was the Roger Taylor song, though. That really was.
Right. But you get a little glimpse into the yes. kind of personality that he had. And, you know, he tried to say that it was an effort from both of them, but he couldn't right. do it. He just couldn't do it. He had to say, well, lyrics, music, I did it all. I did it all. Yeah. It was really my song, but no, all it was right. Roger's song.
Yeah. So let's go to our last segment. This is segment 5. He talks about creativity, a little bit about his parents playing in Sun City and a bunch of other topics. But this is the final segment of our interview with Freddie Mercury of Queen.
How'd you get to be so creative? Were you a creative little kid?
I don't know. It's just a lot of people are creative in their own way. It doesn't have to be just in the music or whatever. They're creative and all that.
Many people never have the opportunity to bring it to fruition.
No, that is part of talent as well, you see. I mean, you can't... I've always maintained that. You can't just sit at home and say, look, I'm so wonderful, I'm so creative, I'll just wait. No, you've got to go out there and actually grab it and utilize it and make it work. That is part of talent. Having talent is one thing, but to actually use it and feed it to the masses is another part of talent. It goes hand in hand. I know there are a lot of people I know who are very talented in the way that I feel, but they just haven't made it because, I mean, they haven't got that extra that extra thing that's needed to actually sort of it's called hard sell, I think. You know, you just got to sell your ass. You just got to go there and ram it down their throats and say, here I am, I'm creative, I'm wonderful, and here, eat it. You know? So you have to do that, yeah.
Even though success came very early in life to you, it almost seems like you never considered failure. I mean, you're so confident.
Well, you mustn't. You consider failure and you fail. It's just... I think my whole lifestyle is like that. It's not just to do with my career, it's to do with everything. It's even a painting, or if I buy a house or whatever, it's just got to move. I mean, if the house crumbles, I just build it again. That's the way I think. I mean, I don't go around saying, oh God, I've lost it all, that's it, that's the end. No, I have this natural inbuilt drive that I think will always be there. Thank God I've got that, you know. It's just and failure doesn't elude me. Elude is not the right word. Failure doesn't. I don't get disappointed. I mean, you learn by your mistakes and all that. I mean, it's experience. If something goes wrong, fine. You learn by your mistakes, and I just go. And sometimes I value that, you know. I don't mean total failure, but sometimes I value that. I think, okay, I know I shouldn't have done that, but it's the only way you can learn.
I can remember you telling me a couple of years ago that your mom and dad, when you first started out, were not too happy about your choice of career.
That in itself instilled me into thinking that it should be right. I mean, the key figures or whatever always had a rebellious upbringing or whatever. You know, you've got to rebel somewhere. I mean, I just rebel all the time. I mean... Look at all the what's, I mean, like, say, the Sex Pistols with them, that was there. I mean, look at what Boy George is going through right now. I mean, he's just, especially in middle America, I should think, it's just, you know, they're burning his records and things. Wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And he knows how to use that and enhance himself.
Oh, yeah.
Notoriety is always a good factor.
Are you on close terms with your parents now, though?
That's about the same.
Of you, though.
Well, they're proud of me. Of course they're proud of me, especially now. Of course they are, yeah. It's just something that... I think parents are always like that. They always just want their son or daughter to do well in what they, you know, what they choose. I mean, sometimes, of course, in the early part of us, parents always have a preconceived idea of what their sons and daughters should do. But afterwards, I mean, you grow up and you take over and... I think a good parent should just basically sort of see what, you know, the son or daughter wants to do, and just help him that way. That's the way I see it. That's what a modern parent should be. But I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I'm just I'm quite a loner as well. I mean, I don't like getting help from other people too much. I mean, I do research, but I don't like anybody sort of handing it out to me on a silver plate. I like to do it all myself.
You do feel a great obligation to your fans, don't you?
Oh yes, I do. But I my greatest obligation is to myself. To be
honest,
it is.
It should be.
And I have to do it that way, because if I do that, if I put me first, then I know how to deal with myself and come across better to the people who buy my records. And so there you go. I mean, I just it's a matter of policy, and policies change, and it's a phase you're going through or whatever. All I want to do, I just don't want to do the same thing over and over again.
Almost all the artists who have played Sun City, which you mentioned, including Frank Sinatra, have received enormous slaggings from the press about playing in a racist country. Do politics enter into your thinking?
Politics have, yeah, but I mean, they enter into my thinking, but I mean, I discard it, because I mean, it's just, we're musicians. I mean, when we went to South America, we got, you know, branded for, you know, playing. I mean, we went there for playing to Argentina, and we had a war with Argentina about 3 weeks later. And the funny thing about us after that, Under Pressure, which happened to be out at the time, was like, it happened to be number one in England. And the funny thing is that the stations in Argentina were playing it as well for the forces. It was actually in the BBC News. It was quite outrageous. It just goes to show that we actually didn't. I don't like to be political. Music is very free. I mean, it depends on who you are. I mean, John Lennon can do that. I don't write political songs. I mean, well, Queen don't. Queen write escapist songs. They're for people who can go in there, escape, and then come out. We don't have political, hidden political messages in our songs. It's just not the way we are. We just like to play. And we're an international group. We like to play to every audience, anywhere, for music. And if politics enter that, then that's tough shit. It just have to be. We don't go to different territories in a political way. We're not. We're just an English rock and roll band that play music for everybody.
Just a bunch of guys.
But we are. That's what we are.
I know.
We might take our music seriously in terms of musical content and things, but not in terms of trying to preach. You know, we don't want to preach through our songs.
Yeah.
Songs, I told you that before, they're just there to listen to, make people happy. It's like, I mean, I'd hate to go to listen to any band who's trying to preach me and telling me or tell me about. People are aware of all the ups and downs in the world today, and then I don't want people singing about them, to be honest. I mean, I don't want them singing about wars and the sadness or whatever. Okay, I write the odd sad song or whatever, but that's neither here nor there. Basically, my songs are fantasy or fun or dance or a certain thing that I've created, but it's got nothing to do with the world that is at the moment. You know, it's just it's not political.
Stickles said I should ask you about Korea. When did something funny happen to Roger and John in Korea?
Actually, to be honest, I don't know.
On this last little promo tour?
Did he say that?
No, I should ask. You know, he was yucking it up.
There you are. I don't know. I'm the last to hear. See, I haven't seen them when they come. They've only just come back, and I left town. So I really don't know how that went, to be honest. I didn't even know Roger was in town until I found out that he was back in England.
Mm.
I haven't heard anything about it. I know they've been to Japan, Australia, and I know that Roger was supposed to go to Los Angeles. I don't even know if he went there.
Mm.
You couldn't tell me that, to be honest.
I don't know. Haven't been there in a while myself.
No, I don't know if. Yeah, I don't know if Roger. I don't know what Jerry said to you, but. No, I don't know. I don't know how that went. Basically, what happened was they'd undertaken this promotional tour earlier on, and we were in the middle of doing this new promo, and their bits were done, and then I had to sort of hang out and work with the Royal Ballet and all that. So I was spending most of my time routining with them and working out, you know, the dance sequences and things, and while Roger and John were doing Japan, Korea, and Australia, I guess.
What are your feelings about so many bands seem to be undertaking tours with big sponsors, be it a beer company or a perfume company?
Yes, I think that's I think it's a good step. I think that's another. It's a new form of making money. You know, merchandising seems to make more money than normal tours, to be honest. Meaning, when you do a tour, you can make more money out of merchandising than just ticket sales. And of course, the moment people, it's a new thing. It is like video is a very new thing. Out comes different ways of, and it'll always happen. Yeah, I think sponsorship is a good thing.
So
if it gives you money, of course.
Yeah. I love your honesty.
Listen, I'm here to, you know, I'm not. I think any band will do that, and I think we're into sponsorship as well. But I mean, at the moment, we're talking with a very big firm, but I mean, I won't mention. And depending on what happens, I think it'll go very well. Yes, I know. Yeah, Pepsi Cola with Michael Jackson and things like that. Yes, I think it's something that I think a lot of bands are going to do.
So the next step for you personally, then, is obviously the solo project.
Yeah. And I'm going to. I think a lot of things are going to evolve from that. You see, at the moment, it's an embryo, to be honest. It's a very, and I don't want to sort of start getting all the aspects of it all sort of creeping. I want to be in a way kind of left alone and make sure it's okay, and then start putting my feelers out. And out of it could come all kinds of things. Like, I mean, I'm hoping that maybe one of the songs could be a part of a feature film. That could be one tangent. Maybe work with a couple of other different artists, so that can be a collaboration in terms. Make videos of my own. I mean, I'm dying to do a video that I feel that I just can do all by myself. So there's so many different areas that I can actually pinpoint from my solo project, and I think that's going to take up most of my time in the near future, and that's enough for me, you know.
Is there not a Queen tour in the near future also?
Well, you see, the Queen, yes, but I mean, the Queen. Near future, okay, the Queen tour, the Sun City thing might happen, say, July, or after, and then after that, this is what I was trying to tell you, it's not going to be like major tours. We're just trying to think in terms of just doing exclusive concerts in major territories at the moment. The way they're going to be, they're going to come across, I don't know, because we have to still work on that.
Mm-hmm. If you go to Africa, I'm coming. That sounds pretty neat to me.
You must come.
Sounds wonderful.
You must come. I think it's. They've always wanted us to go there, and they say we're going to just pack Sun City out. They've been waiting for us for a while, and I just think now's the right time. I'm not afraid of playing any territories. They've got to be good. I mean, you know, I'm certainly not going to go to Nicaragua or something like that. I'm not stupid, but I mean, if the need is there, and if we haven't played there, I'd like to go there. I think most of the band want to do that too. I think we're also thinking of doing something in the sort of in the eastern, real eastern territories, like Bangkok and Hong Kong, which we haven't done, and Singapore and places
Pretenders
like that.
Pretenders did Bangkok, I think.
Yeah, a few people. Police have done things like
really?
That. But yeah, and why not? You know.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, my final question is. Your birthplace is Zanzibar?
Yes, that's right.
What were your parents doing there?
They were freaking out. Well, they were working for the government at the time. My father was working for the government, and Zanzibar was part of the Commonwealth at the time, and so he was a civil servant, and he worked over there, and there you are. I was at a very early age. When I was about 7, I was put in boarding school in India. So I mean, I went from Zanzibar to India for a while, and then came back to England, and. A very upheaval of an upbringing.
Sounds
which,
like it.
Which seems to have worked, I guess.
I guess
In a way, it sort of made... I was, like, put in an environment where I had to sort of fend for myself at a very early age, which I think was I got a very good grasp of how to be responsible at a very early age, and I think that's... That's why it's made me into such a fiend.
Well, you're a good fiend. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Is there anything I haven't asked you that you want to tell me about?
I can't think of anything. I've forgotten all the things I've said.
Thanks, Freddie.
And you know, Sun City was a long time ago. When we say Sun City, what we're talking about is that the United Nations had imposed a cultural boycott on South Africa because they were condemning apartheid. Most of, you know, little Stephen got
right, yeah,
you know,
he did a
people
song,
together
yeah.
and they not going to play Sun City, and it was a big deal. But a lot of performers like the Beach Boys and Linda Ronstadt and Frank Sinatra, Rod Stewart, Elton John, they all played anyway. And Queen got really, well, they got severe backlash from that.
Remember, this is before Mandela was released, so.
Right. And it was just, you know, really bad for them for a while. However, they always strongly defended their decision to play. And they said, you know, we're going to play to anybody who wants to come and listen. We're not a political group. Mm-hmm. But you have to wonder if today how they feel and how Freddie would feel.
It'd be amazing. You know, had he lived, let's see, he would be 70 years old today, something like that. Well, and I wonder what he would be.
You have to do the math, you know.
Yeah.
I can't do
Well, he died at 45, and that was 95, right? 90, yeah.
91, I think.
91, was it? Okay.
I believe so. Anyway, yeah, he would have been an old man. Mm. So, but you have to wonder what he would have thought of it.
Not much older than our audience.
Because people change, and things change, and things that were acceptable or at least questionable in the 80s, not so much anymore. So that would have been, I wonder if he would have ever said that was a regret, or if he would have said, of course, they were in a way a political band just by the nature of how he lived his life. He, you know, he died in 91. He was born in 46.
Right.
So
he was, okay.
Yeah. So you people at home that are scoring at home, do the math, and that's how old he would have been. But yeah, it's pretty amazing. And they never won a Grammy. They got a Lifetime Grammy.
Isn't that amazing?
But they never won a Grammy. And of course, he along with Queen, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2001, Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2003, UK Music Hall of Fame in 2004. So, you know, they did get all those awards, but all posthumously. And yeah, really a shame, really, really a shame. I think I would have liked this guy had I known him.
What was the new bit of news that we had about Bohemian Rhapsody? Didn't they just crossed a milestone with that?
Yeah, Bohemian Rhapsody, which is, you know, I have songs that I call great songs about bad things. You know, Down by the River, I Shot My Baby, you know.
Is Hey Joe on there?
Pardon?
Is Hey Joe on there?
Yes, that's okay. Exactly right. That's okay. Another great song. That ends badly. And I think Bohemian Rhapsody is definitely a great song that ends badly, you know, but in the true operatic sense, you know, which I guess is what they were going for. Mm. But yeah, there's a new milestone. I'm just trying to find it here.
While you're doing that, I'll let people know that I we're going to have Mick Rock on. Mick Rock is the really well-known photographer that took the famous picture that's on the Queen 2 album with their hands crossing. And he's the one that set up that shot. And I have him describing, you know, we'll have him describe that whole thing and some other stuff. So he'll be on a future episode. And we'll get back. We'll do Brian May and Roger Taylor and John Deacon. And who knows, maybe we'll find another Freddie Mercury.
Well, Queen became the first British band in history to have a song reach diamond sales, and that's the diamond sales certification by the RAAA. Bohemian Rhapsody surpassed 10 million sales and streams in the United States, more than four decades since it was released. So, stunned. The band is stunned.
Now, to be truly honest, the two songs did outsell it, but they don't count. One was the Princess Diana tribute that Elton John did, where he took whatever that song was and changed it. And the other Do They Know It's Christmas? Because that was a charity single.
Right.
They both sold
an excess. The band says, all those wild dreams we had, actually Brian May, all those wild dreams we had, this is beyond any of them. Huge thanks to all who have believed in us over the years.
Hmm. Wow.
It was their first top 10 hit in the U.S. and in the U.K. it was number one for 9 weeks, which was a record back then. A record of a record.
Yeah, a record of a record.
So there you go. But the most streamed song of the 20th century, its music video was the first pre-1990s music video to reach 1 billion with a B views on YouTube.
Wow. That's
I know.
Wild.
I know. Insane. Yeah. And well, then there's a YouTube channel.
yes,
for them that they've got now. If you still can't get enough, and we understand Queen fans, they wake up singing Bohemian Rhapsody. Yeah. But yeah, there's a YouTube channel that I guess it's part two now. So Queen, it says recently, so I guess in the last couple of months, launched a special archival YouTube series commemorating the band's 50th anniversary. Queen the Greatest promises a number of incredible trips through memory lane. And the second installment of the series premiered. There's a couple of early gigs at the Rainbow in London. And 1974 was the year. And yeah, let's see, it's the day they truly arrived is what they're calling it. Okay. So that would be interesting to watch. Yeah.
Anyway, I hope everybody enjoyed this. I was knocked out to put this together. I'm glad we did it. And that's pretty much going to do it for this episode of The Rock Podcast. If you want to get a hold of us, hello@TheRockPodcast. You can send us an email. Check us out on Instagram, Facebook. What am I forgetting? Twitter @TheRockPodcast. And thanks for your letters that have been coming in and emails. It's great. Glad everybody's enjoying it. Looks like the Doors show is getting the most reaction so far. But we read everything, and we appreciate the feedback. So, Anita, until next time.
Okay. See you then, Denny. Bye, everybody.
Okay. Bye-bye.